Okay, so let's get started. It's actually, I'm Ivan Balan, and it's a great pleasure to be here. And I'm very honored to be presenting with my two very esteemed colleagues, with whom I really enjoyed working over the last few years. And what we're going to be discussing today is about combining MI with other psychotherapeutic approaches. And why talk about this? Well, we know that MI has been increasingly used in combination with different types of psychotherapies, whether it's DBT, whether it's, you know, behavioral therapies or purely cognitive therapies. And I currently work in a psychiatric research clinic. And as the MI person in that clinic, I'm often approached by one of the principal researchers and said, you know, says, you know, I wrote this grant and I proposed that I was going to combine MI with, you know, fill in the blanks. And my jaw usually drops because I'm like, what made you think that you were going to combine these two things? And, you know, it's always been an interesting challenge, and I'm noticing that some of these combinations seem to be much more easy to do than others. So I began to think about, you know, having a discussion here about what people's experiences were about what seems to be working better than other combinations. And we know that, you know, in terms of combinations, we can talk about, you know, a couple of MI sessions to increase motivation to enter a treatment, or we can talk about a treatment that's really where the MI is really integrated throughout the treatment. And which of these might be better approaches with which types of psychotherapies? So today we're going to present four different combinations that we've kind of been involved with. And then we're hoping to not talk a lot. So hopefully we'll be done talking by halfway through this presentation. And then we're really interested in hearing other folks' experiences with combination therapies, which include MI, and what they have found has been helpful or has worked well and what hasn't. And the thought is, you know, if we were, you know, my mindset is if we were to offer recommendations or guidelines to folks who are thinking of combining MI with another psychotherapy, what might we ask them to think about? What might we say, you know, these seem to work a little bit better than these other combinations. So hopefully that's something that we can all kind of work together as a group. And first we're going to have Terry speaking about MI and CBT for alcohol use disorders.
I'd like to discuss the experiences we had combining a motivational interviewing with cognitive behavioral therapy, and not just CBT, but also 12-step facilitated therapy. And we did this in Project Combine, which was a large multi-site trial to test, essentially to test the effectiveness of two medications, naltrexone and methotrexate, on problematic drinking. And I'm not going to talk much about the combined trial itself and the outcomes of the combined trial because it's not the focus of this panel. However, for the combined trial, a behavioral intervention was developed called CBI, the Combined Behavioral Intervention. And I'm going to spend my time, I was one of the people who was responsible for quality assurance for the combined behavioral intervention. So the University of New Mexico and Bill Miller's group was responsible for quality assurance. I was working on that project and so listened to many, many tapes and came to a pointed understanding of the difference between motivational interviewing and CBT and how interesting it is to try to integrate the two of them. So first let me say, what did CBI look like? CBI, the people who were tasked with developing the combined behavioral intervention knew that they needed a state-of-the-art behavioral treatment to accompany the medication trial, because the research tells us pretty clearly that medications for problem drinking and many other kinds of psychiatric disorders really are less effective or not effective if they are not delivered within the context of a psychotherapeutic intervention. So the people who sat down to design this wanted to make it data-based and use the best empirical evidence they had, and they looked for problem drinking, and they looked to the other randomized controlled trial that had been done and found that there were actually no differences in three of the main treatments that had been tested, that is cognitive behavioral treatment, 12-step facilitated treatment, and motivational interviewing. And so in a unique stroke of genius or madness, they decided to combine them, which is exactly what they did. They designed a treatment that front-loaded motivational interviewing, used as its backbone the spirit of MI, and implemented cognitive behavioral treatment once the MI sessions had been completed, and used 12-step facilitated therapy as an important component of the treatment. The entire intervention was to be delivered with the MI spirit, and so a lot of time was spent training interventionists to get that right. The MI intervention was front-loaded and was allowed to take up the first 3 sessions and frequently ended up taking the first 6 or 7 sessions. After session 5, the clinicians were tasked to move forward to develop a treatment plan, and that was to be done by session 5 no matter what. And we had some trouble early in the trial with people getting to session 10 and not having a treatment plan, right? Which is what you get when you have a lot of people who are good at MI talking to a lot of people who are ambivalent about changing their behavior. So we implemented a rule that you had to have a treatment plan by session 5, and that was a good rule to allow us to make sure that people moved along, and it tended to be a bad rule in another way, which I'll talk about in a minute. Cognitive behavioral modules were selected by negotiation between the clinician and the client, and they included things like drink refusal, urge surfing, mood management, job training skills, and so on. And more importantly, abstinence was the only treatment goal that was allowed. And I have this in quotation marks because it always strikes me as funny that we as clinicians think that we can allow clients to have some other goal besides abstinence, as if they came through the door ready to listen to us and we tell them that they can't have controlled drinking as a goal. The interesting thing about the combined trial is that thanks to the foresight of Bill and some of the other people who designed the intervention, there was a recognition at an early stage that it didn't matter just what treatment was delivered, but also how it was delivered. And so some process measures were front-loaded, built right into the beginning of the trial. And the manner in which CBI was delivered was evaluated from the beginning using a rating form that addressed therapist characteristics as well as some of the client engagement measures in the delivery of CBI. We included ratings for, I'm going to call them therapist interpersonal skills. They were things like warmth, genuineness, acceptance, and so on. When you do a factor analysis, all of those things factor onto one factor, which is essentially therapist skills, direction, empathy, protocol. We also rated the specific content that was offered, and we did that by capturing which module the therapist was using. So we have a really nice way of measuring both the content that's delivered and the manner in which it's delivered. Let me talk about some of the specific dilemmas that were unique to blending MI with this CBI treatment. The first was transitioning to a treatment plan, which I already talked about. So our MI, people who are good at motivational interviewing had some trouble transitioning into a treatment plan, particularly when the client was saying things like, I'm just not ready to change, or I don't think I want to change my drinking, or I think I want to cut down on my drinking, or something like that. It became difficult for them to implement a mandatory treatment plan when they really didn't feel that the client was going along with them. And anybody who's good at MI knows that that's probably a bad idea. So the good MI therapist knew they shouldn't force a treatment plan, but they were required to do it in the cognitive behavioral treatment protocol. Now, this is a problem that would theoretically not occur in the real world, because in the real world, if the client tells you they're not ready, you have the option of saying, well, that's fine, and I understand you're not ready to change right now, and I hope you'll consider coming back to see me if you change your mind. But in the codependent world of a clinical trial, clients are never allowed to drop out unless, if you can possibly help it. So we struggled to keep our clients no matter what, and we didn't allow ourselves the option of saying, well, why don't you, we honored the autonomy of your decision not to participate in this clinical trial or change your drinking, and you can certainly come back and see us again. We didn't do that. Instead, what we did was we made the ambivalence the focus of the treatment plan. And so we told the therapist that they could allow the client's ambivalence about making the change to literally be the first thing that was on the treatment plan. Now, there wasn't a module for that. so it was a little bit of a protocol violation, but it was a workaround for trying to make people have a treatment plan when they weren't really ready to. And it was just an area of disconnect between trying to marry MI with CBT. Another problem was client autonomy surrounding a treatment goal. I've already mentioned that many of the clients wanted a moderation goal and specifically came through the door saying, I intend to cut down my drinking, but I'm not going to stop drinking. We told them that abstinence was the only goal that was allowed in Project Combine, but again, they didn't listen to us. They said, that's very nice, and I'm going to cut down. So therapists were not allowed to confront this directly because that would have been MI inconsistent and that would have earned them a ding. They knew that, and so they didn't confront the client directly. And they sort of ignored the client when they would talk about a non-abstinence goal. And that was okay for a while, but then they started complaining in their supervision sessions that they didn't feel they were able to help clients because they knew strategies for moderation, and they knew strategies to help people control their drinking, and they weren't being permitted to use them because they were not in the protocol, right? That wasn't allowed. And so they were very frustrated and grouchy about it, and they were distressed because they felt like they were not able to be as helpful clinically as they could. The workaround that we came up with was that they would try to engage the client in a period of sobriety sampling as opposed to a lifelong goal of abstinence or a permanent goal of abstinence. So even when you're using moderation strategies, one of the common things you do is start with a period of sobriety sampling, and so we asked therapists to focus on it in that way rather than talk about complete abstinence. And the interesting thing was that made some people happy and some people unhappy among the therapists who were delivering CBI, and I'll talk about that in a minute. This same dilemma is common in clinical settings. The client has one goal and you have another. And one of the areas in which I think MI really is, the tension between MI and other interventions is this very one. What happens if there's a mandated goal or there's an outcome that the therapist really has to embrace if the client doesn't want to? And really, are we still doing MI if we're not 100% respectful of client autonomy in choosing their goals? On the one hand, you might have the opinion that it really can't be MI if the therapist has a goal that is not the one the client chooses. And I certainly hear people argue for that very eloquently. And on the other hand, you might say that really we never are 100% supportive of client autonomy anyway, and there are plenty of situations where we don't support client autonomy, we just don't talk about it, right? So of course it's still MI. And what I would say is we really don't know the answer to this question yet, and I don't think there is an answer, but it's an interesting dilemma, and it fit right into the talk, so I just decided to include it. Another specific dilemma was the selection of treatment modules, and that is MI consistent therapists had difficulty being directive enough when they were negotiating modules for the treatment plan. So if the client would say something like, I don't need urge surfing, right? I don't have urges. I never have urges to drink, and I don't need this module. That was pretty much it. The MI consistent therapist would say, okay, well, let's talk about something else. And it was we had to implement strategies to force therapists to push a little when the client was not initially endorsing a module. Because we decided that, you know, just because you're respectful of autonomy doesn't mean you have to give up every brain cell you have when the client says, I don't think I want to do this, right? So clients would say things like, I don't want to bring a significant other into this treatment process. And that was one of the things that we tried to get them to do in CBI, was to bring a significant other for social support with them into the treatment sessions. And very commonly the client would say, I don't want to do that, I don't need to do that, I don't think that's a good idea. And the MI consistent therapist would say, okay, fine, let's talk about something else. So we made a policy, the workaround for that was three strikes and you're out, which was you have to try three times. You have to try three times. So initially when the client says no, you say, okay, fine, is it okay if I revisit this with you later? And if the person says yes, then you revisit that later, and then similarly you revisit it a third time. So the person has to turn you down three times before they're able to finally hear the end of you on that issue. Another dilemma with treatment termination, very common for clients to suggest that they should quit, that they were done. They had 3 or 4 or 5 sessions, and they were pretty much where they felt they wanted to be. Things were better for them, and they didn't want to come to treatment anymore. But again, a clinical trial really increases, it really is creates a lot of codependency in therapists, and so we don't allow clients to quit early until they have finished 16 sessions, right? And they're not allowed to get better until they're done with 16 sessions. So this was a dilemma for the MI therapist who really kind of wanted to support self-efficacy and say, yeah, well, wow, you're really done, you're really ready, go ahead, go for it, and really support their idea that they were ready. And they couldn't do that because that was a protocol violation, and their job was to keep the person in for as many as up to 16 sessions as they could. So there was no workaround for that. They just encouraged them to stay. So I'd like to point out some of the underlying ideas that cause this itchiness between what I think are the underlying ideas between CBI and MI. And one of the underlying ideas is that resolving ambivalence is not enough. Clients can't change without new skills, and treatment is what changes behavior. These are ideas that underlie a cognitive behavioral approach, and they are in many ways contradicted by our experience and our thinking about MI. Another idea is that MI can be helpful in engaging clients, but it's not sufficient. So if you think about things from a cognitive behavioral perspective, it's really not helpful to get a person past 3 sessions and resolve ambivalence and then expect that they're going to change because they haven't had any of the effective ingredients of treatment. Whereas what we know is that often 3 sessions of MI is enough to help people change their behavior, and in fact that it's often as successful as a full 16 sessions of CBT. Another idea is that therapists and not clients should define the appropriate outcome goals because they have particular expertise. This is not an underlying idea behind MI, but it certainly is in CBT. In other words, the therapist has expertise or knowledge which is specifically helpful to the client, and therefore they should be the ones that tell the client what to do. Similarly, that information and teaching by the therapist is critical to helping the client change. Here, then, is the true magic in CBT, which is the client learns new skills and gains new information, and all of that comes through the therapist. And these I've already mentioned. And I'll close by saying that the combined project yield, because of the way the combined project was designed, first of all, I'm only talking about the CBI piece. There was also a psychoeducational intervention for those patients who received medication. So anybody who received, well, actually, so that was everybody except one small group. Received in a, some people received CBI and some people received a medication management, some received both. I'm only talking about CBI. We're now currently analyzing data in which we have 718 clients with drinking outcome, 27 therapists, and sessions for all of those therapists and clients, in which we've rated therapists for empathy and interpersonal skill using a reliable and relatively objective behavioral coding system. We've also rated change talk in those tapes, and we've been able to rate it in a way that's reliable and allows us to be confident that we're measuring change talk. And we have drinking outcomes up to 1 year that are measured in a very standardized and reliable format. So you can see that when we combine this data with the correct statistical analysis, which I think is turning out to be HLM, we're going to have a very interesting story to tell about the interaction between what therapists do, how they do it, how it impacts what clients say during treatment sessions, and how all that's related to drinking outcomes at 1 year. So stay tuned.
So I'll be talking about a couple of the different interventions that we developed combining MI. And the first one is behavior activation therapy. And I was wasn't a trained behavioral therapist. So when I was first told that I needed to integrate MI into behavior activation therapy, the first thing that came to my mind was Terry and her chicken camp. As she's training the chicken to go up and across the bridge. And I'm thinking, how am I going to get MI into this process of behavioral change? Luckily, I was pleasantly surprised. Let me tell you a little bit about behavior activation therapy. And we're using the model developed by Lejeune, which is a brief version of this. And it can range from 6 to 16 sessions. And contrary to cognitive behavioral therapy, really BAT focuses on the behavioral part, right? So what we're trying to do is help folks identify meaningful activities in their life and begin to engage in those activities so that the reinforcement from the pleasure actually begins to change the mood. Right? So different from the cognitive behavioral therapy, we're not helping folks overcome their cognitions or their thoughts about not being able to do these activities. We're just going right into the activities. And when I first started reading, one thing that didn't come across, but it came across as I spoke to BAT therapists, was really the focus on self-efficacy. We're working, as I'll mention to you, we're working with a pretty challenging population. And it was very clear from the thing, the first behaviors that you select are things that you know they're going to do and they're going to do well and they're going to succeed because you want to build upon that self-efficacy. So I was like, ding, okay, got my first MI thing that I can work with here. So let me just give you a very brief overview of what a BAT intervention might look like. And this is called Let's Act, and it's a 5-session intervention developed for adolescents in inpatient units for drug abuse. And this was focused on their concomitant mood and depression. So you begin pretty much with introducing the treatment, explain the treatment rationale, and at the very beginning you're just asking them to monitor their daily activities. They're not supposed to change anything. They're just looking to see what they're doing. And at the end you do a planned relaxation exercise with them. Session 2, you once again review the treatment rationale. I learned that this was a very important part of doing this treatment. And you continue to review the daily activities and now begin to identify some activities that they could be adding. And part of this is looking at folks' values and goals in life. Because since we're trying to select behaviors that are meaningful, you're going to derive them from important values and goals. The next session would be to then begin to implement with the patients how they can incorporate some of these activities into their daily life. And session 4, you begin, and you actually ask them to schedule it into the following week or into the following day, whatever time frame you're working with. And beginning the subsequent sessions, what you're really doing is that you are just touching base with the patient to see how the activities went, what else they want to add, and see how it's beginning to affect their mood. And as I mentioned, this is brief. It's only 5 sessions, but it can go up to 16 sessions. And if it were a longer treatment, it's that same process of reviewing activities, adding new activities. You select from different, they might have begun focusing on activities that are related to one value or one goal. You can ask them to select a different value or goal that they want to work on and identify some activities related to that. So it's the same process pretty much repeated. So this was the integrated intervention that we developed. And at this point, the treatment manual has been developed, the intervention is developed, we're ready to take it to the field, so I might need to be presenting next year about how well this went or how badly it bombed. So the way that this has worked out, it's about 10 sessions. And what we're trying to do is train counselors working with methadone patients to develop this intervention. The purpose is there's in many of the inner city clinics, there's a limited amount of staff with advanced training. So we're thinking if we can help the counselors provide a basic level of treatment, and we can assess if patients are improving at that level. Those who aren't would then be moved up to other clinicians for more formal cognitive behavioral therapy or for medication. And at least in terms of the writing and seeing the integration, this was one combination that seems to have worked, that seems to be working well. So this is the outline of how the intervention came out, right? So we have 1 to 2 sessions depending on what is needed in terms of building motivation to enter this treatment. And it's a met light, right? Because basically the feedback they're receiving is that when they first come to the clinic, they fill out a physician's health questionnaire, which asks about symptoms of anxiety and depression. And during the session with the counselor, we just feedback the symptoms that they reported and begin to inquire about how those symptoms are affecting the patient's life. right? Really, this is building motivation so that they will accept entry into BAT. So once they enter into the BAT sessions, it has been very easy to maintain an MI spirit throughout these sessions. There are some places in which BAT requires a more didactic mode, so we're trying to really engage the patients in that rather than make it just allow them to be just passive recipients. And this, in the review of treatment of the treatment model, is where the biggest challenges occurs. So basically, what we're trying to do is that, although in the initial sessions we're helping the patients understand the treatment model, then afterwards we're actually engaging them and filling in what the model is like based on an experience that they had during the week. As they begin to identify the pleasant and meaningful activities, instead of just identifying them, this is an excellent opportunity to really evoke from patients what would it be like for them if they were engaging in the activities, what that would add to their lives. Basically, building motivation at this more micro level, not just to enter in the treatment, but to really engage in these activities. And similar, as they begin to incorporate it into their lives, to not just check off the fact that they did an activity, but evoke from them how, you know, their feelings about the success about the activity, what it was like for them as they experienced it. And really, these are now things that are incorporated into how the review of daily activities and the adding of activities is done. I mentioned earlier that an important part of this is working off of the patient's values and goals. And as we all know, that's a very important aspect of MI. So that was a very easy way of blending these two treatments. And towards the end of the treatment, we establish, you know, some activities post-treatment and decide with the patient if it would be helpful for them to maintain some contact with us on a monthly basis, or if they would prefer to touch base as needed. So this one kind of worked well. Now let me talk a little bit about cognitive motivational behavior therapy from problem gambling. You know, there's a pro, there's always a not-so-pro. So let's talk a little bit about just the cognitive behavioral therapy that we're using as part of this research study. And this is kind of a combined model which really favors the cognitive portion of cognitive behavioral therapy. So a lot of it is focused on helping the patients identify and challenge their beliefs around their odds of winning. So, and I'll show you, there's multiple sessions around this, and there's lots of lists, which will really make you never want to play the lotto again, unless you just want to give more money to the state, you know? But it's basically just, you know, as folks think about, you know, no, I was thinking that I was kind of short on money, and if I could make, you know, go to the casino and, you know, and just, you know, win $500, that would really help me out. Right? The approach from a cognitive therapy perspective is to help the patient really challenge those thoughts and say, well, how effective has this been? Well, really, if I'm thinking that I'm going to win when I go to the casino, let's get them to really think about the chances are that if they're in gambling treatment, they've been losing all along. Huh? Now, this is actually a very effective therapy, right? And we see some folks really responding well to this treatment. Again, it's not really something that I was, you know, I got trained kind of psychodynamically, humanistically, and all that kind of stuff. Huh? But in doing a lot of the gambling treatment that I've been providing, I've had to learn multiple approaches. And this has actually really works well for some patients. The issue is how to integrate MI with this kind of an approach. So this is just a very basic outline of the treatment, right? So session one is just whereas we as kind of MI folks would use it to begin to build motivation. Now this is kind of just introduction orientation to the treatment. Then you have some NET components. So there's a report that's given back to the patient based on their intake, responses to intake about how much money they've lost, how much money they spend during the week. And here we use life goals to build commitment to change. And then we really shift into cognitive interventions, right? And it's really different ways of confronting these cognitions and the odds of winning, things of that nature. There's an optional session with a significant other, and then there's also some training in terms of problem solving. Now the issue is that the way that this intervention was designed, it was supposed to be an integration of MI and CBT. Right? And what you can see here is that, at least the way it's presented, it's very front-loaded with MI, but then we kind of switch to cognitive interventions. And this is one of the interventions that I've been involved with that really made me think, well, you know, maybe that might be much better to do with some types of interventions than others, right? Because what we're seeing is a lot of confusion in the part of the therapist in how to really combine these approaches, right? So in this treatment, the CBT really dominates the intervention, and the therapist is an expert. And it's become very confusing for the therapist to understand when to switch between MI and CBT. So obviously, during the course of the treatment, you have folks that have gambled once or twice. You have folks who are kind of have wavered in their commitment to abstain from gambling. Another issue is what constitutes, if, you know, as developed, you know, the therapist should be going into MI when they encounter resistance. Well, what exactly constitutes resistance in this intervention? It has never really been clear. And also, there's a sense of, you know, these therapists have two supervisors. So they have me on the MI side, and then they have the cognitive therapist on the other side, right? So we'll be listening to a session in a joint supervision, and there's a great opportunity. I'm like, oh, they went and gambled. They were thinking about us. Well, let's evoke. Let's engage, right? And the other therapist is like, nope. Let's confront irrational beliefs. Yeah. So really, there's an opportunity to many opportunities during the course of treatment to really respond from either of these sides. So which one does the therapist respond from? And clearly, there's this thing that once you label something as an irrational belief, that's pretty conflictual with MI, right? I had worked with a previous gambling intervention, and the way I managed to eventually approach this, it was an irrational belief session that occurred towards the end of the intervention. And I would say, you know, I oftentimes hear funny things from patients, and I'm wondering if these things cross your mind. You know, I've had patients say that after they left my office, they played my office number, you know, or they played my telephone number. And at this point, you know, this was like the seventh session or so. So folks were really kind of, at this point, mostly abstinent. And they're like, oh my gosh, yeah, I used to do the craziest things. So this guy who worked in a grocery store used to play the labels on the cans, you know, the numbers that weren't. So they could really be engaged in this process versus my convincing them that really this is really irrational. Right. But this is a pretty difficult, you know, for folks who work from a cognitive perspective that you really supposed to challenge, it's a difficult combination. So as I mentioned before, this is one of the situations in which I wonder, well, is it just better to do MI at the beginning to build motivation to go through this treatment and then just cleanly do cognitive therapy? Right? So which of these combinations might actually work better? And now I want to pass it off to Alan.
So for those of you who don't know, LHM is linear hierarchical modeling. Hierarchical linear modeling. Yeah, I recognize the term, although as you can tell from the fact that I got it backwards, it's not exactly my area of expertise. But Terry used the acronym. I thought I might just throw that out there. For you non-researcher therapists like I used to be and still sometimes am, I want to talk a little bit about the challenges of integrating MI with exposure and ritual prevention, or EXRP therapy, for OCD. So for those knowing that not all of you are therapists, some of you are working in criminal justice and are as non-therapists, probation officers, just a little bit of background. OCD is a disorder in which people engage in repeated and lengthy immersion and obsessions, compulsions, or both. The obsessions are thoughts, persistent intrusive thoughts that are recognized to be unrealistic most of the time by the person suffering from them, thoughts about being contaminated, or if I do something, a loved one is going to be killed or harmed, that the person tries to neutralize or suppress these thoughts. That is, they find the thoughts disturbing, and so they try to find ways to make the thoughts less disturbing, and this is through compulsions, which are behaviors that are intended to reduce anxiety, but which are not realistically related. So if I have the thought that, if I believe that if I do something or have a particular thought, my mother is going to be harmed, I then have a counter thought or a counter mantra that I have to repeat or some other act I have to do to make sure that that doesn't happen. So the compulsive behavior reduces the anxiety, but in fact doesn't really, isn't realistically tied to the feared belief. And people with OCD spend at least an hour a day, and very typically many hours per day, trapped in these kinds of repetitive, intrusive, obsessive thoughts and engaging in compulsions, whether behavioral or often mental compulsions, to neutralize or suppress those thoughts. EXRP, exposure with response or ritual prevention, developed by Edna Foa and colleagues, and it's really a very simple treatment in a way, as behavioral treatments tend to be. Simplicity is often their beauty. It involves getting the person to expose themselves to the obsessive or intrusive thought without engaging in the ritual. The idea being that anxiety habituates. That if you allow yourself to feel anxiety or fear for an extended period of time in the presence of something, the intensity of the fear diminishes. That's just the way our bodies work. And that what people with OCD need to learn is if they don't ritualize, if they don't do something to suppress or in other ways reduce the anxiety, that the anxiety itself will go away and it will no longer trouble them and they will no longer have to continue to ritualize. And they will also not be upset when they have these intrusive thoughts because they'll realize that everyone has these odd thoughts that come through our minds from time to time, and that if you don't get freaked out by them and do lots of stuff with them, they just kind of pass through your mind and it doesn't really disturb you. And so you can expose people either directly, so for someone with cleanliness type of OCD, you'll actually take people into the bathroom and have them touch the bathroom floor, touch the handle, do things like that, and not ritualize. In some things you can't do it in real life, so you do it imaginally. So imagining that I did something and my mother actually was harmed by my having done this, and tolerating the idea or the thought of this until the anxiety diminishes. So to do it, EXRP, normally there's two introductory sessions where the hierarchy of obsessions and rituals are developed and the plan is developed and then the exposures are conducted for 15 sessions. To integrate MI into EXRP, we expanded two sessions to three and we tried to build and weave in the evocation of change talk for changing OCD and also for adhering to or committing to the treatment and developing an EXRP-focused treatment plan in a more MI-congruent way. And then for the rest of the sessions, the therapist would engage in straight CBT, exposure and ritual prevention, as long as things were going well. But any time the patient would resist, that is, be reluctant to do the exposure homework or to do an exposure in the session, if the patient did not respond to the usual CBT-style way of dealing with that, which was to repeat the rationale for the treatment, to re-educate, to encourage, the therapist was supposed to shift into MI, into an MI module, which they would then engage in to try to re-engage the patient into the behavior therapy treatment. And this was expected to come up fairly regularly because, as you can imagine, if you have somebody who's terrified that if they are exposed to germs that they're going to die, and then you say, okay, now I want you to go into this bathroom and touch the toilet and not wash your hands, people often resist doing those things. They initially say, are you insane? And then when they learn that it's an effective treatment, they say, well, okay, I'll try to do it, but I think you're crazy, and I'm not sure I can. And so we expected resistance to come up regularly. The style of EXRP is highly structured. The sessions are laid out very clearly. You do this, 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 and this. It is a highly directive therapy in which the therapy is presumed to be the expert. The patient is presumed to be acting and thinking irrationally, engaging in magical thinking and other kinds of problematic ways of thinking and behaving. The therapist, therefore, has to instruct the patient very clearly on how to do the exercises, what to do, and all of the steps. And it is considered to be extremely important that the patient adhere completely. That is, after the second or third session, the patient is supposed to be doing zero rituals outside the sessions. And they are told that if they are not allowed to do those rituals, and if they do, they need to talk about, and each session is checked on how many, what percentage of the time did you ritualize this week, and so on. Sounds a lot like MI, right? It's about as far, and if any of you who know of or know who NFOA is, know that NFOA doing this treatment is sort of the epitome of the alternative to MI. Because it is a highly effective treatment, but it is highly structured, fairly rigidly enforced, and patients are told what to do, and if they do what they're supposed to do, they get better. So, for example, here are the guidelines for normal behavior related to washing. Patients are given a series of guidelines, and this is what they have to adhere to. They may be prevented from, this is actually what they're supposed to be able to do after they've gotten better from their OCD, and now they're going to do relapse prevention by not engaging in any other behaviors. During treatment, they may be told they're only allowed to shower once a week. They're only allowed to wash their hands once a day. They're not allowed to wash their hands after going to the bathroom for some period of time because it can reinforce, and the experience is ritualizing, and therefore reinforce the existing connection between magical behavior and anxiety reduction that the treatment is trying to break. So I started with two therapists who were highly experienced in OCD treatment. Very skilled OCD behavior therapist who had minimal familiarity with MI, and did an extended training. They first read MI2, they watched the CASA tapes and talked about them. I conducted over the course of the study 4 one-day training days, which was just with 3 participants, so it was highly interactive, highly active, lots of practice. They did pure MI sessions, so they were given patients to see where they were not doing this blended sort of thing, but asked to just to do MI with patients so that they could learn what it felt like to do that. They did MI-EXRP training cases, and they had weekly phone supervision with me over the course of the entire study, a good couple of years. We spent many hours doing MI supervision. MI fidelity was monitored by a coder blind to treatment assignment. coding using my just the globals to code the opening 20 minutes of session 1, session 3, and 3 randomly selected exposure sessions. It was thought that it was likely that if MI was going to be happening during the exposure sessions, it would be in the opening minutes because a patient would have come in and say, I didn't do my homework this week, and I'm not doing this crap anymore, and I think you're crazy to make him do these things, that the therapist should shift into MI at that point. And so we randomly assigned patients to be getting the pure EXRP or MI-enhanced EXRP. They were rated for adherence to the treatment using a scale developed by the investigators, which turned out to have excellent reliability and very good construct validity, so it was a good measure of whether patients actually were adhering to EXRP. And what happened, this was a small study. We had 30-odd patients, so this was really a pilot randomized trial. Both treatment groups showed clinically meaningful decreases in OCD severity. There was no difference at all in outcome in terms of whether you had pure EXRP or MI-enhanced EXRP. Didn't matter whether you looked across the overall change in the sample or response rates in the two groups, no differences. And no difference in adherence. Patients getting the EXRP enhanced by MI were no more and no less adherent to the treatment than were the patients who got the pure, highly behavioral version. We then looked at the MIDI global ratings. And as you probably know, for MIDI 3, a global rating of 3.5 would be considered beginning proficiency. 4.0 out of 5 is considered competency for MI. For EXRP, the mean MIDI globals were less than 2 at all time points at all measurements. So EXRP is a highly non-MI style treatment, and that was reflected in the global ratings. For the MI plus EXRP therapists, the MIDI ratings during introductory sessions were significantly higher than those for standard EXRP, and in many clinical trials, that's all you would look for. Was this more like, were the two interventions different, and therefore, do you have a meaningful comparison? During exposure sessions, the two treatments differed significantly on all MIDI ratings, but direction, so both treatments were highly directive, whether MI-focused or not. However, the empathy global for the MI plus EXRP therapist was only at the level of beginning proficiency in the introductory sessions and was below that level during the exposure sessions. Scores for MI spirit, so putting back together the composite of autonomy, collaboration, evocation, were below beginning proficiency levels at all assessment points, even during the introductory sessions where there was no exposure going on yet and the therapists were encouraged to weave MI thoroughly into the sessions. During the exposure sessions, scores on all global subscales except direction were below 3.0. So in other words, they were counter MI, despite having been technically the MI plus EXRP. So this is the question then, what happened? And this is the question that I've been thinking about for a while and trying to answer, and I can't give you definitive answers to this question. In fact, but when I prepared this talk, I thought maybe I would just say, what do you think happened? But I decided, actually, no, I do have some thoughts, and so I'm just going to mention four hypotheses, four possibilities about why, despite the extensive training and close supervision that I provided to these therapists, apparently they weren't really doing very much MI in the MI plus EXRP therapy. So one possibility is that they still just hadn't learned how to do MI. But despite the training, they didn't know how to do MI, and so when they tried to do MI in this integrated intervention, they just weren't doing it. That explanation I tend to discount, because when they did the pure MI sessions, when they saw patients and were told, no exposure, no behavior therapy, we just want you to do MI with this patient around, it was actually the question of whether or not to engage in treatment. These were patients who had OCD but were ambivalent about starting any kind of treatment at all, and the goal was simply to engage patients through MI into moving towards some positive steps to addressing their OCD. And in those contexts, they were able to do MI pretty well. So I don't think that it was that they didn't know how to do MI at all. The second possibility is that they didn't really know when to do MI, particularly in the exposure sessions. That is, that me as the designer of the manual in particular, and the designer of the integration, haven't done a good enough job of laying out for the therapists, when these things happen, this is the time for you to switch from standard exposure therapy and behavior, a CBT approach, into an MI approach to engage patients consistently. And I think there is some validity to this reason. Although we tried very hard, we gave them, they had a typology of resistance, and they were told fairly explicitly, given guidelines of when you hear these types of things, when the patient does X, Y, and Z, once you've tried your usual CBT approach to dealing with that, if the patient keeps doing it, that's when you should switch into MI. So they did have guidelines, but I think they probably needed clearer guidelines and perhaps even a more defined sort of algorithm, so that it was unambiguous for them when they should switch from the standard CBT style into the MI module. A third explanation, which is not exclusive of the second, but may also be true, is that they knew how to do MI, but they weren't as confident in their ability to do MI as they were in their ability to do CBT. They were highly experienced and skilled EXRP therapists. They were newer to MI. And maybe when push came to shove and they were encountering resistance and sort of knew that they should do MI, they didn't feel that they were going to be able to do it as effectively and that they would be more effective if they stuck with what they did better. And since they didn't have the confidence to do MI really well and didn't think they might be able to have the effects of re-engaging the patient into exposure that they wanted to, that they simply defaulted to their more comfortable and familiar approach. And I think this explanation had a significant amount of validity to it. I think this is a good part of what might have been happening. And then there's a fourth possibility they identified, which is that they didn't really believe that MI was going to do anything. And that it wasn't that they didn't think they knew how to do it or they were worried they wouldn't do it well enough. They simply deep down believed that the way to get these patients to do this treatment was to do the things that they had always done and had been taught to do, and that switching to MI would be less effective, even if they did it well, than doing their standard CBT approach well. And I think, as many of you suspect, I also think that there was a lot of this in the therapist, despite the fact that Dean Fixon, we selected these therapists carefully based on their commitment to learning MI and to seeing the validity or the interest in integrating MI. We went through a careful selection process and we trained them and so on. It may still be that at bottom they didn't buy it. And I can tell you that I listened to many, many hours of this type of therapy, listening to these therapists at times spending 10, 15, 20 minutes literally, you know, in a nice, and these were both highly skilled and kind, gentle people, in the most kind and gentle way, arguing with the patient, trying to persuade and convince the patient who was essentially saying, I don't think I really need to do this exposure, it's not really that bad. This is telling them why and why they should and why else they should and how they should was extraordinarily painful at times, as I'm sure many of you have experienced. And yet, in supervision with these same therapists, sort of struggling with the therapist, struggling with, on the one hand, recognizing, understanding what I was saying about how an MI approach would be different and potentially take them in a different place, and at the same time, having this strong sense of, I got to get them to do it, because if I can only get them to do it, then it will get better. So, in conclusion, I don't have any answers to the question of what works and what doesn't, but I just sort of put this out there for consideration in thinking about, we went in thinking, I don't want to just do a prelude intervention. I don't want to have pure MI for two sessions and then have them do standard CBT, because that was the alternative. We wanted to integrate MI into this treatment in a meaningful way and deal with resistance and disengagement effectively. And at the end of the trial and where we stand now, I guess the question is that really viable? Is that really a sensible thing to do? Can it work? Is it just these therapists? Is it just that I didn't do a good enough job of training or supervising or guiding these therapists for how to do it? Or is this some fundamental disconnect that is likely to lead to therapists who are really committed to an approach like EXRP to not ever really use MI or employ MI effectively in the context of the therapy? And that is where I will stop.
So as I mentioned in the beginning, really we're interested in hearing others' experiences in some of these combined treatments, things that you have done. And we just have some questions up here. Obviously, these are not the questions that need to be answered, but just some questions for thought. in terms of what other interventions you've been involved with, what have you been finding has been working better than others, and really this issue that Alan brings up, right? You know, what about the therapists? How do we help? We know that from the, you know, 8 tasks of learning MI, the ability to shift back and forth among MI and in different modality is one of the most advanced skills. So how do we prepare therapists to do this? And oftentimes therapists are just then being trained in MI. And, you know, certainly any other questions that the presentation evoked.
I had a question. Alan? Charlotte. Did you ask the therapist what they thought happened?
That is a very complicated question. So I could simply, because you asked me a nice closed question, I could simply say, yes, I did, and stop there. But the elaboration on that is, yes, I did. And I think the therapists themselves, at various times, would have answered that question in different ways. At times, the therapists seemed to really believe that they were trying to do MI as much as possible and not feeling confident in their ability to do it, or not really knowing for sure that this is when they were supposed to do it. At other times, as will happen, is over the course of supervision, it emerged that there seemed to be more, shall we say, resistance to doing MI than might have been apparent along the way, and real doubts about, is MI really appropriate with these kinds of patients? That question that we have all encountered so many times. People with OCD often are engaged in, again, magical thinking and all kinds of and sort of caught and trapped in their rituals, and does it really fundamentally make sense to make the assumptions that MI makes and engage patients in that way versus taking a much more directive, in the traditional sense, stance? So.
I have a couple things. For Alan, seems like it's like a therapeutic entropy or default. You know, they go back to what they're originally trained in, and seems like a combination of explanation 3 and 4. So my question is, have you already set up your new study in which you take MIers and train them in OCD treatment?
It's a really good. Is Jim Carter here? Darn it. I was really hoping it would be. That's a really good question. And no, the answer is no. I have not set up that study. And I part of me wants to, where we need that slide of Monty Python again, the killer rabbit, with me saying, run away, run away. I'm not really sure that I would want to invest another several years in that process. But you're right. That's a really interesting question. What would happen if you started, as Terry did, started with MI therapists and trained them in CBT? Would that make a difference?
What you have, therapists that don't want to push, right? That want to quit as soon as the client says, I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Which clearly in EXRP would make an ineffective treatment. They might. Yeah.
I have one more thought in answer to the general question for discussion. Is I've been working in South Africa with HIV/AIDS and working HIV clinics, but my favorite place to work is in the townships with the HIV support groups and with the lay leaders. And there's a great combination with the religious approaches to ministering to the people and MI. And it's something I've been very interested in and sort of exploring. How do these two things go together? How can they go together best? And, of course, there's the spirit of MI, but it's not a religious spirit. And so I just think that's something for us to look toward, since so much of the world is very strongly religious.
Another question to Alan. Just wonder if at the time when you were conducting the research, but also now, if you believe that an integration between such a directive approach and MI, a real integration, is possible.
I call me romantic, but I do. And I think, if I were really going to do this study again, and I guess stranger things have happened, or another version of it, I do think explanation two was also part of the answer, that we would have to be giving much clearer and much more sort of algorithmic guidelines to the therapists to shift, for when to shift into MI, particularly early on. Because I think until, like anything else, as we know, until you experience success with something, you don't really fully believe that it's going to work. And so the therapists were reluctant to shift into MI, possibly for various reasons. If they knew this was the time to shift into MI and they did it, on those occasional moments when the therapist did, when I heard the therapist recognize, oh, wait a second, this is time for me to stop pushing and really sort of ask the patient, what's going on here? And tell me a little bit more about what's concerning you about doing this exposure right now. We saw sparks of positive impact. We did see patients moving more back towards engagement, the revision of the exposure so that it became manageable for the patient, and the patient was willing to do it, and yet still acceptable to the therapist as something that would be moving the treatment forward. So I continue to hold out the possibility that it's possible, but I think it's extremely difficult. And really, I think the real question may be, is anybody going to be willing to expend the effort and the money required to be able to create that kind of integration in therapists? And that, I don't know the answer to.
Just a couple of thoughts. One is that it might not even be desirable. One of the issues, I think there are two issues that are present. One is, if you go to adult learning theory, adults tend to learn best when they are feeling tension and frustration with what they're doing now. And my guess is that most of the people here became attracted to MI because they were frustrated and feeling tense about what they had been doing. And that one of the other processes, again, in adult learning theory, is that you usually have to take on a new paradigm, you usually have to reject the paradigm that you had been using. So I'm not sure that ultimately that looking for integration is necessarily the holy grail. Vaughn Keller.
Denise Ernst, and it's really interesting to hear that, because I just wanted to talk a little bit about a study that I was involved with diabetes educators. And we made the decision, this was a research project that went on for about 5 years, and we made the decision that we wanted to try to integrate diabetes education with MI, not do a prelude, but really integrate it, and we randomly assigned the educators to whether or not they got training. We had these two diabetes educators that got training got a bucket load of training, and over several years, and there were at least three mentees, including myself, involved in training them, and ongoing coaching and supervision and listening to their sessions and doing all this stuff. And they were, the people that came into the program were uncontrolled. Their diabetes was really pretty uncontrolled, so the goal was to lower the hemoglobin A1C. And in a variety of different things. And it was a complicated design. It wasn't just MI, but it was a complicated design. But the upshot of it was that I coded all these tapes to misc-coded them, and there was absolutely a difference between, on the global ratings, between the people that had been trained and the people that hadn't. My ones that had not been trained were down there at 2, and my ones that had been trained were consistently at 4. Which on the old scales, on the old early MIDIs or MISC scales, was right in the middle. So they weren't reaching proficiency. They never reached proficiency. But they were consistently different on every single coding measure there was. And that went across the whole 3 or 4 years. In the end, there was no there were some differences between the groups, one of which was that the people that were the ones that had both the MI woven education, they had improvement in their A1Cs, but not as much as the people who just had straight education. And what we haven't been able to look at all the data completely, but what my sense is that in a way, the standard diabetes education was really, it works. If people attend to it and they do it, it works. And I think we diluted the education by adding the MI, and I think if we had tried the prelude, it might have been very different. We might have had different results, who's to say. But it seemed to me like in the process of trying to really integrate it, we were taking something that was effective, two things that were effective, and kind of mushing them together, and then they were less effective.
So, Denise, one thought I have about that is that I really think the clinical indicator for motivational interviewing is client ambivalence. And we make a mistake when we assume that people are going to be ambivalent, and therefore education is not helpful, right? Because there are people who are ambivalent about receiving information about how to manage their blood sugars, and then there are people who are not.
Yeah.
Right? And you might see an effect if you differentiated your intervention based on
where people were.
Whether people are ambivalent.
Well, we saw plenty of ambivalence in there. People were ambivalent, and there were a couple of things that happened in addition to the diabetes educators all of a sudden that got trained found themselves having very different relationships with their clients than they'd ever had in their life. They were in the middle of these relationships that ended up feeling much more therapeutic. They didn't feel like educators anymore. They clearly felt different. And they were having relationships that they were not really prepared to have, that they hadn't been trained in how to have that kind of relationship. And the clients that came to them were also unprepared for it. And they ended up getting in these kind of mushy relationships. I mean, there were so many things that ended up happening in that integration that we hadn't really expected. And even when they did hear ambivalence, they weren't really sure. They tried to do some of it, but they would go back and forth and do some education. It was just a really interesting way that it played out that we ended up going, well, this probably wasn't the best idea.
Here we go.
Hi, this is fascinating. Love this. And it makes me think about our discussion yesterday about motivational interviewing in groups. Hi, Mary Velasquez, Austin, Texas. So it makes me think about MI in groups, and I've been thinking about this for quite a long time. So you guys are talking about one behavior, one therapist, one client, and think about multiplying that with a lot of behaviors. So a substance abuse group, for example, where people have three or four or five or multiple drugs, multiple people, and how do you go back and forth? So we've really struggled with this, and I think there are more questions than there are answers. We presented over the summer at RSA with Terry some data on a group that we had. These were cocaine abusers, and we put them through a series of groups, and it was all the early groups were to build motivation. Later groups were more kind of CBT, relapse prevention oriented, but most people went through the first six groups that were very motivational interviewing, mighty coded, good, all everything they needed to be. We compared that with a psychoeducational or an advice, education advice group. What we found in the end was that the people who were less ready to change at baseline did really well in that more motivational interviewing group. The people who were more ready to change, who were really ready to get going, did better in the education group. So what do you do when you're thinking about groups? So this morning, I was on a call with, as part of a scientific advisory board with Phoenix House. Lots of people know Phoenix House. They're all over the country. They've gotten great training. Some of our mentees work with them. They get coaching. They're trying to do all the right things. And they asked me, well, what do we do with our groups? We've got people in all different stages of change in our group. And we're trying to use motivational interviewing. We feel like we're learning it, but we just can't use it because our people, many of them are ready to change, and the ones who are ready to change, we keep using our motivational interviewing, and those people are getting frustrated. And so it's much easier for these counselors to go back to say, you know, I like MI, but it's not going to work. And so, you know, well, you know, obviously they can't. take your early stage people and put them in one group and take your, well, come on, you know, they're not going to do that. So I think, I mean, this is a very, very interesting and important area, and I don't know where to go next on it. I think we need lots more research and lots of smart people to think in that direction.
I kind of have a question, and I guess it's more towards in Terry's direction, Joel Porter.
Where are you from, Joel?
I don't even know. I live in Christchurch, New Zealand. Originally, we don't need to get into me. What my question is, when you're starting to look at, for all three of y'all, obviously, when you're starting to look at the blended approaches, when you're blending MI with CBT, with BAT, with exposure therapy, and you're modifying your coding, it sounds like it's what you did, Terry, with the CBI, to try to tease out how in tune that the therapists were with motivational interviewing whilst they were doing other things. What are you starting to see? Because the more I'm listening and reading and going to presentations, there's a lot of blending going on, and I'm wondering if we're doing a hybrid MI, or how do you know it's MI going on? When you're actually trying to...
with CBT, would you be doing psychodynamic therapy? Right? It we all are concerned about, you know, MI, but I think the same thing is true of other kinds of therapies as well, and it's really not different. So I don't know if that answers your question or it doesn't. I don't know the answer, but I think it's the same question you ask when you have very different approaches that have different underlying assumptions, and you try to blend them, you really have a new thing. You don't have the old thing, right? And so I guess my point is, and John Houck and I wrote a chapter, which is coming out in Hal Arkowitz and Henny Westra's new book about using MI and combining it with other kinds of treatments. We wrote that CBI chapter. And the point I'm trying to make in that chapter is that if you're not thoughtful about the ways in which MI and your other treatment match and don't match, then you're doing it mindlessly. And you have a whole lot of error variance in the way you're delivering that treatment. And you're not thinking about what are some of the interesting disconnects between MI and those other treatments. And that's what worries me. It doesn't worry me that there are disconnects. It doesn't worry me that there are conflicts. It worries me that we don't even know there are, and we don't think about it when we're delivering the treatment.
Opened up a can of worms for me about, you know, to what degree are the instruments we use to measure MI appropriate for these blended interventions, and are they, you know, tapping into more common elements of therapeutic interaction styles that predict change, or should we have modified instruments? And I guess I'm just excited to see emerging research on the predictive validity of the instruments both within MI and as applied to other domains.
I'll just say this. I'm talking with Sean Thomas and other people about what I think is really important to some of the research that we have to evaluate the confidence people have in MI and studying like the criminal justice system, for example. So when I see mighty ratings that criminal justice provides to people who are probation and pretrial service, for example, and they're using probation surgery, they might be doing some things right, and they might be implementing it as well as I could ever expect they would, and their mighty ratings just be wrong. And they're never going to get any better, right? Because the things that we want them to do on the mighty are just never going to happen in the context of that interaction. I really wish we had instruments which capture sort of the best practice for that particular area, as opposed to having a generic instrument like the mighty, which I think is very good for psychotherapy interactions, in which you're free to support autonomy, and not necessarily the best thing for using it. What I consider adaptation of motivational interviewing for a setting like criminal justice, where you're not always free to support autonomy. Just a thought.
Hi, Barb Kistenmacher from New York City. I hate microphones, so, whoa, that's scary. But I could be Jackie Hecht, because she lent me her name tag, so if I want to engage in hanky-panky, I'll just be Jackie. But this may be a little, my thought might be a little on the clinical side for this discussion, but my sense about CBT and MI, and maybe I'm making it too simple, and I'm guessing maybe other people have thought about this as well, is that when I'm working with a client in CBT, and we're at a moment in the therapy session where the client is talking about, I'll give you an example, like I have a client who has a daughter who's 5 years old. Oh, sorry, I don't use these things very well. Am I yelling? Okay. I have a client who has a daughter who's 5, and the daughter smacks him in the face and then laughs, right? And that's a moment where he's talked about wanting to grab her, and at times he has grabbed her and, you know, done things that he wished he didn't do later. But at that moment in the session when his daughter smacks him in the face and laughs at him, and I'm doing CBT and I'm asking him, what was it that came up for you right in that moment? And he says something about, well, how could she love me if she smacks me in the face? And then we, you know, we do the downward arrow technique, and I say, well, if she doesn't love you, what does that mean? Well, then at the point in therapy where you get to the irrational thought or the core belief that's getting triggered, such as, you know, I'm an incompetent person. He thinks that if his daughter smacks him, she must not love him. And if she doesn't love him, then he must be a bad father. And if he's a bad father, he's not good at being a father. So there's his core belief being activated, that he's incompetent. I might be giving you too much detail, but I'm trying to get to my point. At that moment in therapy, to me, where MI is helpful is when we get at that thought that's being activated, and he gets extremely anxious, and I can tell it's a very tough moment for him, that's when I feel MI kicks in. When I reflect back to him that, you know, a non-judgmental reflection at the moment when the patient feels anxious and is experiencing a dysfunctional thought, there's something extremely validating about that, such that then his resistance to looking at the other side of that thought goes down, and he's more open to kind of engage in other types of thoughts or feelings associated with that situation. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but it means, yeah, many good therapists are probably sitting there going, yeah, yeah, that's what I do in my sessions. So I don't know how that translates into this talk, but I'm wondering if there's a way we can sell the shifting in MI to, let's say, a CBT or a behavioral therapist, if there's a way we could sell that moment of helping the person feel less anxious such that they're able to work within the rest of the model. And I know this isn't revolutionary. I'm just kind of tossing it out there. And Paul Wachtel writes about this, but more from a psychodynamic and CBT perspective.
I think one thing that becomes really important, and it struck when I heard Terry say it during her part of the presentation, which is the spirit in which one might do CBT. So folks who, you know, as in the study that Alan presented, were trained EXRP therapists and CBT therapists, you know, they might have been doing some MI techniques, but to what degree was the spirit really underlying the EXRP portion, right? I think that as I was working on the BAT combination, it was very easy to see how kind of a, you know, intervention that focuses on building self-efficacy, I can maintain MI spirit throughout that. Right? So Barbara, I can imagine also that you as, you know, somebody who's well-trained in MI and uses MI would do a CBT kind of from that perspective. And I think that once we're kind of in this MI mindset, the possibilities of using many of the techniques and many of the approaches of MI in a CBT perspective really open up. I mean, I you know, as Alan mentioned, I was the coder for, you know, for this study that he presented. And I can't tell you how many times I would be listening to tapes and I would be, you know, reflecting or jumping in, you know. So clearly, you know, as he said, there's plenty of opportunity even with an EXRP to really use, you know, an MI approach, whether it's, you know, spirit-wise and technique-wise. But I think that what you're saying is really points to this kind of engaging a CBT therapist or someone who's much more familiar with CBT, almost using MI on them to really feel more comfortable in seeing the value of integrating this into the treatment approach.
Okay, great. Oh, sorry. That is really loud. We have time for one more question.
Well, this is a kind of comment, I guess, and I'll be brief because the time is coming to an end. I'm Steve Cole from New York, and I wanted to comment, which is a kind of question to the panel and the group as well, but quickly, not so much on the integration issues of psychotherapies and MI, but this problem that's come out again several times now that some people are more ready to change, and if they are, then MA might not be appropriate. So as a clinician, I've struggled with a lot of this in trying to change health systems and help people change working in self-management support in the public sector chronic care model. So I want to suggest at least a little bit of what might be a little bit of a paradigm change because, you know, we're faced with the problem. The people who are ready to change, maybe MI isn't appropriate. So the problem then is clinically, so when are we going to use MI and when are we going to not? So my paradigm suggestion is that maybe we can use MI for all these people, and Bill's and new model helps me think this through, because if there's an engagement phase that is appropriate for everybody, that's appropriate for everybody, then focusing and evocation and planning, and let me just wind up in 10 or 15 seconds, I'm suggesting paradigm-wise that we focus early on the planning side and think of it more as an MI introduction into planning, because some people are kind of ready to change, but it's not that easy to do planning. And so there's a lot that we learn in MI from some little pieces of evocation and focusing that aren't that complex, but we can begin with an early planning probe, use some skills of MI, and work with that. So not think through in that linear way, engagement, focusing, evocation and planning, but move quickly to the planning and sprinkle in some MI, and that at least, I don't know if that's a complete paradigm change, but a little bit that I think can work.
Thank you.
Just to mention briefly on that, one of my hobbies is actually writing treatment manuals, and this doesn't work well in MI, but I really enjoy it because it makes me think about what I tend to do as a clinician. And one of the things that I really began to do in more recent manuals is, you know, before I used to write, okay, in the first session we're going to do these MI exercises to build motivation, the second session we're going to use these, and the third session we're going to use these. Now it focuses more on, okay, you have up to the first three sessions to kind of really begin to rev up motivation. Because there's, with a greater awareness in mind that, yeah, there's some folks that are going to walk through the door and really be ready for where they're at, you know, and to begin to take action. And those folks, as we mentioned, you know, doing some of mine with them might actually impede the process. So it becomes really important for us to be aware of, even though we really enjoy doing MI, where folks are at and how much of it we actually have to do to help them. Okay. And I think
great. Let's give them a round of applause.